Hi, and welcome to another edition of Point of View. I'm your host, Sean Maligatfalvy. Today on the program, we're going to have BUSU President Cooper Millard and Vice President of Finance and Administration Christopher Yent to talk about the wide array of Brock student campus politics. We're talking about everything from the student life fee to the new bus routes to the 24-hour study space, new student center, and more.
The 2% to 7% quorum requirement for a petition to be valid. What we've also found, at least from my experience, and Cooper, you can address this from your experience because they're often different, that the people that sign a petition are often not the people that vote. They're often two separate quadrants of people. And so our hope is that by allowing this as a facilitation mechanism, we'll find more people that were a separate set of the student body, right? I mean, the people that may sign the petition are just people in the hallway, but they may become people that go and vote. And so by requiring more people to sign a petition, this is more people that you're inadvertently providing information to who may recognize, hey, look, there's a political process going on. Oh, we vote on stuff. Well, what do we vote on? Well, maybe we want to get involved in the voting process. And suddenly when they see that their signature's been dropped on something, they may actually open up the email that they get in their Brock mail.
Essentially, the President's Task Force is meant to be a body that seeks to recommend and provide recommendations and prioritization for all programs at Brock. Now, that was the mandate that was set out previously about 4 or 5 months ago. Recently, the last University Senate meeting, there was a motion that was passed on the floor that stated that the President should, or urged the President of the University, to kind of divide the task force. The task force now is focused, I think, more towards an administrative end. Now, I can't 100% speak to that because it hasn't been released publicly. I would only assume from the chats that we did have in that room that it looks like a lot of the academic portion of the program review is now going to be deferred over to Senate and ARC, which is the Academic Review Committee. Now, again, that is just speculation. That's my personal opinion. We will see on the website very shortly, on the Brock University website, if there are going to be major changes.
Today on the program, we have some announcements for referendums at Brock University. Student-led petitions have brought two new referendums to this October's referendum, announced that last week at BUSAC. Presented last week at BUSAC was the $20 per credit student life fee has been challenged by a petition and will seek a referendum to repeal the fee. Anthony Deeb has organized a petition which achieved quorum and was presented to BUSAC this past Tuesday. As well, a student-led petition organized by BUSAC counselor Danielle Hunter was circulated around campus and also achieved quorum to defund Brock Radio. The Brock Radio is $1.50 per credit. So these are the announcements that we have this week. Also, there is announcement from the artificial turf facility at the BUSAC meeting. BUSU President Cooper Millard told us that the artificial turf facility will not be going through this year. And so he has withdrawn the referendum from this upcoming October referendum.
Earlier, financial circumstances in the university that we stand now and the budgetary constraints, coupled with some other factors, it just can't become a reality this year, and that's to my everlasting dismay. Very disappointed because it is a promise that I made in my platform, and it really irks me, as Chris would also say.
So that means there is a believed to be record amount of referendums, of four referendums. The referendums we have are the constitutional amendment referendum, there's the Student Justice Center referendum, there's now the Brock Radio referendum, and the student life fee referendum is back. So if anyone remembers, of course, from last March, the student life fee was presented from the athletics students, the hockey team, Brianna Veal and John Del Duca were on the Yes campaign for the student life fee. It with 4,060 voters, 54% voted in favor. I was a member of the No campaign for that fee. So that has been about 6 or 7 months ago. And since then, I have become a radio host here at Brock Radio and am employing myself in the direction of journalism. So I won't be taking a position on the student life fee, but I am very interested in understanding the implementation of the fee. We've invited the Brock University administration through Kim Mead's office to come on the program, and she says that she's arranging for the administrators in charge of the three departments for this fee to come on the program and talk in depth. We have in the studio now Brock University Students Union executives, Cooper Millard and Christopher Yent in the studio. Thank you so much for joining us, fellas.
Thank you for having us.
So, Cooper, will you tell me a little bit about your background? What is your major, and how did you get involved in student politics?
Well, my major is political science. Was political science. I graduated actually last June. Our bylaws dictate that so long as you are enrolled in undergraduate courses, as long as you are running for election, after that, it's up to you how many courses you do take. I chose instead to kind of focus on the job rather than defer courses for this year. I'm hoping to audit some courses to, you know, stay in the kind of student experience. And my first interaction with BUSU at all was actually volunteering for Shinerama. Then it kind of built. I worked closely with BUSU when I worked for Smart Start for 2 years with the BUSU executives. I was closer and closer with them. Good friends with Sohail Ahmed and previous executives like Jane. And I actually sat down with some of them and asked them about their job, and they just spoke volumes to the experience and to the awesome people that you get to work with and you get to meet and the cool things you get to plan. So I kind of decided in December, before the election period, to run for VPSS, and was fortunate enough to be elected for VPSS, and was fortunate enough to be elected president this year.
So tell me about yourself, Christopher Yent.
So I'll try and keep it concise enough that I don't bore every listener who's hearing, because my involvement with campus politics has been pretty long and kind of ongoing. So I'm a concurrent education student. I'm in my fifth year of concurrent education. I deferred my fifth year of teacher's college in order to be able to focus on the job full time. I felt that I didn't want to give students kind of half of the student experience, even though they elected me in good faith. And so I've deferred my teacher's college for next year. And I guess my involvement with campus politics and at least student politics started at the end of my second year. I remember watching the debates for the executives in February, and my roommate said to me, well, you should be up on that stage. Why aren't you up on that stage? And I thought, probably not for me. I don't really want to do that. And then my good friend Ibrahim Qureshi, who sadly is resigning now from council after 3 years of serving on council, bit of a moment for me, but he kind of provoked me to go into campus politics, and he provoked me to kind of get involved. And he said, hey, you should be involved. You should be running for student council. You should be sitting on the same things that I'm sitting on and I'm going for. And he beat me in that election, and I have no problem saying that he beat me in that election. And then from there, I kept trying and getting involved. And I think that's my biggest message to anyone, is that try. I mean, I've run in 7 or 8 different elections now for the student union and lost the majority of them, but won the ones that counted, I think is the wise words that someone once said to me. And so that was my first involvement a long, long time ago. And Ibrahim Qureshi as well as Sebastian Prinz were the two people that kind of initiated and pushed me and got me going in that direction. And I've loved it ever since.
And you've also been involved in Brock Radio.
Correct. That happened after my first attempt at student politics. I thought, oh, well, I'll go back to my first passion, which has always been music. My dad instilled a passion for music in me at a very young age. And from a very young age, I never differentiated between what was independent music and what was mainstream music. My dad just sort of had a record catalog, and he'd go listen to stuff, and I'd go listen to stuff, you know, Pink Floyd right next to Teenage Head, and didn't understand that everyone knows who Pink Floyd is and no one knows who Teenage Head is. And I didn't realize that until getting involved with the radio station, understanding that there's this whole demographic for independent music. And it really fostered a continuing love of independent music that I think became stronger and more hardened as a result of it. And again, that that whole process was a separate wing of campus politics and student politics, but then facilitated me getting more involved within the student union and campus politics as in general.
So, Cooper Millard, what? Tell me about the various things that you're engaged in this year. For our listeners, you can go to busu.net and you can see the president's and the other executives' reports. So, take me through some of the issues. The ones that stick out to me, of course, are the president's task force, student life fee implementation, and of course, the artificial turf facility referendum. So, there's some updates for each of these topics. That would have been recent developments. So let's start with the president's task force. Bring us up to speed on what's been happening with the president's task force in the last month.
So that's could probably have an entirely separate interview about the president's task force. I know you have previously had representatives from the task force here, have you not?
That's correct.
So I'll just give a brief overview to the listeners who may not have tuned in last week or who may still be confused about, I guess, its mandate. Essentially, the president's task force is meant to be a body that seeks to recommend and provide recommendations and prioritization for all programs at Brock. Now, that was the mandate that was set out previously about 4 or 5 months ago. Recently, in the last University Senate meeting, there was a motion that was passed on the floor that stated that the president should, or urge the president of the university to kind of divide the task force. The task force now is focused, I think, more towards an administrative end. Now, I can't 100% speak to that because it hasn't been released publicly. I would only assume from the chats that we did have in that room that it looks like a lot of the academic portion of the program review is now going to be deferred over to Senate and ARC, which is the Academic Review Committee. Now, again, that is just speculation. That's my personal opinion. We will see on the website very shortly, on the Brock University website, if there are going to be major changes. But in any event, the purpose of this review is to ensure that we do things efficiently, we do things effectively, we do things for the right reasons, and it's to ensure efficacy from the top to bottom in every program, like be it BA political science or co-op, be it physical education as a program, or the Career Resource Center, right? So it's actually all-inclusive of everything we do to find redundancies, to find better ways of doing things, and to, obviously, we're in very dire straits right now financially, so it's to cut some fat. However, the group, the task force, the presidential task force does not do that. We provide recommendations, and that is all. And that's a very common misconception, thinking that anyone in the task force is out to cut people and make huge changes and see changes just from 2013 to 2014 onwards. It's not going to be that. These changes or these recommendations are going to be sent to the Board of Trustees and the President, and they will, with the Budget Committee of the university, carry out those changes in years to come. And it's a really interesting project because in our very young history by post-secondary standards, this has never been done. So this is precedent setting. So we're hoping that this is successful, that we do find some really interesting ways to ensure that our university is representative of our strategic plan and our strategic mandate agreement with the provincial government. And moving forward, we do hold all the priorities that we say we hold within the institution. And it does manifest that all the way from the administrative side to our academic side. So to me, it's a really important project, and I'm honored to be sit on the committee. And if any students have any questions, please ask us.
Yesterday at the BUSAC meeting, there was news that came out that you announced that the artificial turf referendum was going to be canceled for this October. Tell me about the artificial turf referendum, because one of the reasons we invited you in is to like find out about where did this idea come from, what does its plan, and now of course all of those questions are a little moot, but they're still interesting in terms of because as I saw you speaking on it, you seem to express some disappointment that it wasn't going to be able to be brought to referendum this October. So first of all, what is the artificial turf facility, or what would it have been, and what is its status moving forward?
So The field project is something that I was very passionate about. I think it's something that this university is lacking. We do have a fantastic athletic cohort. We have a ton of very dedicated, engaged students. We do have a facility in the Walker Complex that is very advanced. It's a beautiful facility. However, we do not have a turf field for intramural use, for athletic use, and for recreation use. And that's something I wanted to address. And that's something I've wanted to address, frankly, since my second or third year when I went to Laurier and Guelph and Mac. I mean, I grew up in Hamilton growing up on those turf fields playing football and stuff like that. And that's a way that I've met some of my closest friends and made some great memories. So I was hoping to help the university make that a reality here. However, due to the, as I mentioned earlier, financial circumstances of the university that we stand now and the budgetary constraints, coupled with some other factors, it just can't become a reality this year. And that's to my everlasting dismay. Very disappointed, because it is a promise that I made in my platform, and it really irks me, as Chris would also say, any platform point that any of the BUSU executives don't get down. It's kind of something that keeps us up at night. It's something we tried up until the 11th hour. We were looking for donors. And again, this isn't a project that we wanted to just lay on the students to say, hey, pay for this. The students have invested in their community via the student life referendum, via all the ancillary fees they do pay. So we didn't want to just charge them another fee to build a field, and then charge them a fee in a few years to build a students union building, another one, a student center. So what we wanted to do is just forego it for now, until the university did have a better appetite for this field. The only good news that did come of this is there are donors in the community who are interested in donating to a field project, however, just not in the capacity that we had, I guess, organized for this year. So, for example, I mean, this field project could cost anywhere between $2 and $3.5 million for one turf field, including the fencing, including the excavation, including the construction, the labor hours, everything like that. And we wanted to make sure that the students paid no more than $1 million, very similar to what they set out and paid for in the Learning Commons, and that was 5 years ago. It would be a very, very similar referendum to the Learning Commons, the collection of that fee about 5 years ago. And again, students wouldn't have to pay anything additional. It would be taken directly from the Strategic Expansion Fund, which is already taken. And it would be pretty much just a impetus, I mean, placed on the university to say, hey, you know what, folks, we really want this to happen. The students wanted this to happen. They voted for it. Here's that $1 million, go out and find that donor. And what we didn't want to happen this year is to give students false hope in that we would collect the fee, hold it in escrow, and then have to say, okay, you know what, forget it. That fee is not going to the university because we couldn't find a donor. This isn't the fault of myself or the students or the university or donors. It's just the environment right now and the climate right now just cannot support the magnitude of this project. Now, that does not, and I reinforced, it doesn't mean that this isn't going to come in future years. It just unfortunately means that this isn't going to happen this year. And I apologize about that, because I did make that promise in my campaign and on my platform, and I'm not going to be able to deliver on it, unfortunately.
So where are we at with the new student center?
Glad you brought that up. The new student center obviously is a huge undertaking. It's something that all of the executives are quite passionate about. With everything going on with orientation week and homecoming, the entire summer planning out a year, we haven't had much time to sit down and talk about it. However, we have been doing some informal research. One of the really, really awesome models that we've seen here in Canada is over at our counterpart in British Columbia. The University of British Columbia in Vancouver has done a fantastic job planning their new building, and it's being constructed right now. So what they did is they held a number of focus groups to actually ask students what they wanted to see in their building. Then they put forward three models. If anyone's seen Zoolander, very similar to those models that were put forward in Zoolander, a building for ants. But we would probably hope to put that in the marketplace or someone somewhere really public. And students would actually go by and vote on which model they like the best. And after that, we would then go to referendum saying, students, okay, you know what? You've chosen your building. You go ahead now and you're going to say, this is how much we're willing to pay for our building. And then we would go ahead and construct it. We cannot rush that process. It's a very long process. So the only thing I think we're attempting to can undertake this year is the focus groups. We want to see what students have to say, what they value in a new space. Obviously, study space is huge. Obviously, somewhere they can go for counseling, I've heard, is very, very huge right now. Obviously, mental health is a huge hot button issue. We've heard that it's really important for club space, for neutral student space that's rentable, for group space, all that stuff. So we'd like to see other ideas, whether people want slides like was proposed in Vancouver, whether people want a pharmacy or like a rental book library and things like that. So there's plenty of options. I think the students can tell us best what they want to see. We can document that, and then so future years executives can go ahead with the planning of this building and implement it.
I teach kids their ABCs, but we all need to learn about ADHD.
Tabora Johnson, Kids TV star.
My ADHD went undetected as a child. Today, CAMH is working with families to start treatment early to help people like me learn their ADHDs.
CAMH, the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, helps people overcome addiction and mental illness. For help, call 1-800-463-6273. CAMH, we're transforming lives.
Switching over to Chris. Chris, you've been working a lot on the bus routes in St. Catharines. So tell me about sort of the fundamentals of how the UPass works in terms of how much money is generated and how that money is spent. And then the progressive steps that you made this summer to rearranging the bus routes for the students.
So I'll try and answer that in threefold, because the question was threefold. So at the outset of it, every student pays into a levy as long as you qualify based on taking 1.5 credits per your fall winter term. You pay into the bus levy, and then from there that $177.28 goes to six different transit contracts across the Niagara region. They are the St. Catharines Transit Authority, Welland, Niagara Falls, Niagara Regional Transit, Fort Erie, as well as Niagara-on-the-Lake. And through those, we facilitate the mass transport of students both on and off of campus every day. In the case of the St. Catharines Transit Authority, which we have some of the most accurate ridership data for, we move 23,000 rides a day, which, I mean, if you do simple math, is over 10,000 students a day moving in St. Catharines to the campus alone. The majority of those come up the Glen Ridge Hill, and then as it goes from there, you can break them down based on usage per route. And the major shifts we did this year, we recognized that we hadn't done a major redistribution for buses, especially with regard to the STC, in the 10 years of the existence of the UPass. And so it made a lot of sense to look at both where our current trends have taken us in terms of student demographics and population, but also where we're planning to go in the future and where we see developments taking place. Obviously, everything from, you know, where we know land has been allocated to new apartment developments, to where we see apartments being developed, such as Winterbury in the Thorold Confederation Heights area. And so in looking at all of those, it made a lot of sense to do a proper redistribution and a proper analysis. And not to bore anyone with the specifics of how we did the redistribution and the analysis, but I went out in my car and I drove laps and I timed routes and I made a bunch of different options to see what ones were feasible, what ones weren't, compared them to existing routes, times, stops, and coverage, so that we could provide better coverage that through that mechanism. And then in addition, having lived in three or four different locations outside of Brock University, I remember having ridden the bus every day and seeing that, you know, I couldn't get a bus home after 6 p.m. if I lived in East St. Catharines, right? I had to take a transfer at some point, either at the downtown terminal or at the Penn Center. And those transfers times were, you know, they varied between being 15 minutes to being half an hour a transfer time, right? And often it made more sense to walk. And of course, we don't want that for students. We want students to be able to take one bus home. And so now through coverage, there's one bus to take you home if you live anywhere south of St. Paul Street, essentially.
Where can we find the specific details for that?
They are all on www.yourbus.com. there's a very there's you know a couple different bulletins on their main page addressing the fact that hey, we did major changes this year. And then if you just click the Brock University link, there's a list of all of the buses that come to campus based on the STC alone. If you want more specifics for either Welland, Niagara Regional Transit, or Niagara Falls, you can go to our website, www.busu.net/transit, and there's a page there with links to all of the respective websites and all of the route information that's specific to Brock University.
A question that comes up again and again, given the new 24-hour study space, is what about overnight transport? So what's the situation for that?
So we've looked into it, and we've come up with some rudimentary numbers based on three or four different routes within the city. The difficulty with it, the difficulty is multifold, so I'll try and address them kind of broadly. The first problem is that based on where we see student distribution, obviously overnight transit would only be run within the city of St. Catharines, at least as a preliminary, an outset model, based on the fact that our ridership into the other regions is much, much lower, and it's therefore much less feasible to run an overnight route. The second difficulty comes in that because of the way our fee is structured, we can't tender a contract to an outside or a third party organization to run the transit. It must be run through the municipal government, which is all right. But then, of course, we need buy-in from both the municipal government as well as the municipal transit authorities. And because, as you may or may not know, it's not simply the cost of running a bus. I mean, the cost of running a bus is expensive, but then you also have to have a dispatch set up at the times that the bus is operating. So this comes into effect when we have statutory holidays and stuff like that. When the dispatch closes, it's no longer the cost of just running the bus hourly, but it becomes the cost of running a dispatch. It becomes the cost of union dues for the dispatch and a bunch of other mitigating factors. So that also influences the cost of doing the business that we'd want to do. The second, the third or fourth major reason is that the university is a little bit hesitant at this point to offer us a bit of support in doing it. We think that based on some of the new things that have been implemented in the student life fee, that the university should be a willing partner with us in overnight transit and some form of overnight transit. And so we're trying to work with them in order to try and develop some form of an overnight transit model. So again, that becomes a little bit of a, you know, back and forth situation, especially when the university is in financial dire straits. Getting them to contribute to the project is a little bit more difficult, especially when you're working with the timelines of the budgetary process of the university. And then finally, quite simply, we run into a very, I guess, treacherous problem when it comes to running a bus overnight, because obviously there will be students somewhere that choose to try and use the bus as a taxi service if they've gone out, you know, having a couple of drinks or something like that, and they're using it as a taxi service. The bus is not insured for that sort of, the municipal bus certainly is not insured for that sort of ridership, and it then becomes an issue of, well, do we need to staff the buses with NRP members in order to make sure that they're safe? Because obviously there'd be students coming from the campus at 2 a.m. who haven't been drinking, but they may get on the bus with students who are rowdy, who had been drinking, especially when you get towards the end of the week, if you get towards, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, that sort of area. And we want to, of course, make sure that our students are safe on the bus, right? I mean, our job is to facilitate students to and from their academic.
Right. So the academic pursuit, there's actually a BUSU bus during exam period?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, that would be the ride home program you're referring to? Yes. So my job last year as VPSS was to liaise with our safety services coordinator and Chris Green. I mean, institutional memory year to year. He did a great job helping to book that last year. The ridership last year was the most we've ever seen for that 2-week period. That was those or 10 days. We did see, now I don't have the metrics in front of me. I can give them to you if you'd like. We saw hundreds and hundreds of students use that bus home. Now we've changed the route this year to actually service more areas in Thorold. Into my knowledge, at the end of last year, that worked very well. So I'm guessing this year we'll continue that route. And that's a great, great, great way for students to be able to stay up late, study here, and get home safely. Now, the challenge that we have in the future, obviously, that Chris will have to talk to his product's VPFA prodigy about, is whether or not it would be prudent to book that late night or all-night bus, I guess, contract. Now, the contracts have already been negotiated for this year, so it'd be very difficult to go renegotiate them again. However, for future years, now that we know, knock on wood, that this 24-hour space is going to be staying around, it would be definitely an idea moving forward to get those buses to service all night long.
This is 103.7 CFBU, Niagara.
So let's transition towards a conversation about the student life fee implementation. So tell me about what the student life fee is and how it is currently, where it's at in terms of its implementation. It's received its first funding from tuition in since it's now September. So a certain portion of money has been provided to the administration. So the administration has begun to implement the fee. You've been involved in the committees that are implementing those fees. So tell me about student oversight and the actual implementation of the fee itself.
So speaking to my involvement with the student life fee, throughout the summer, we were asked to provide a boost to executive to kind of sit in on the committee to say that there was some oversight. I did say at that committee, having one executive does not mean that you have oversight over this fee. I think it has to be a bit larger than that. To which the reply was, okay, that's fine. When September comes, we will erect a committee. It will have terms of reference. It will have student at large representation. It will have BUSAC member representation. It will have executive representation. And that was the meeting that you did sit on. We were talking about that in the terms of reference as well, that we're still going to be drawn up. Now, the student life recall referendum is going to throw a wrench in the mix a little bit because even though they are trying to be as transparent as possible, there are still students who are very skeptical of the fee, to which I would just urge, make sure you do read up on it before you make up your mind. It is a fantastic initiative in some ways. In others, some would say that they cannot use some of the things that were included in the student life fee. So I'll try to stay as neutral as possible. However, in being involved in the process the entire summer, I can tell you without a doubt that the administrative staff of the university have done a fantastic job implementing this fee. And all of the major promises of the MOU, as you can read, and the list that you have, Sandor, are almost all satisfied, and to be done so early, which is very impressive. I was disappointed not to see the 24-hour space open early in September. However, I think that if you're that far behind that you have to stay up all night to study, then some of our students have bigger problems than a 24-hour space. Chris is giggling. However, I mean, I think they've done a great job. I mean, the 24-hour space, the extra additional nursing staff, the psychiatric help, the free gym pass is going over very well. The gym has not yet hit capacity. They have brand new equipment in there, the free fitness classes. So there's a lot going on. I would urge students to do research on it to see all the things that this does help the Brock community kind of benefit from. Before you do go ahead and make up your mind. But there has definitely been oversight. There is going to be a committee that's going to be set up. And I would urge any students out there who want to find out more to contact gom@busu.net to apply to be a student at large. And that way you can be involved in other BUSAC committees as well.
There's a new committee at BUSAC. It's supported by Bylaw 4200, which is the referendum Implementation Review Committee. This committee says that it will provide a schedule for bringing referendums back to the students. So Christopher Yent, Vice President of Finance Administration, will you tell me about how this fee was authored and what its intentions were?
So how the committee was authored, sort of just to clarify there, because you said
yes.
How the fee was authored? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So
that's right.
So I'll explain, I guess, as best I can. Basically, through conversations that we had over the summer, I mean, one of my old hard and fast policies had been that all fees should have to be reviewed every 5 years, because I felt that based on the cycling of students through the population that, you know, an average Brock student takes about 5.5 years to graduate. So that would allow you at least once during your term at Brock to have a voice and have a vote on whether or not you pay a certain fee. In in wonderful discussions with the rest of the executive, I generally understood that my line was a little bit too hard, and that makes sense. But at the time, I kind of thought it was a good idea. And so what we compromised on and what we decided was a good idea moving forward is creating a committee which essentially does all of the background research work for council to make its decision on whether or not a referendum kind of, or rather not a fee goes up to referendum. Given that in the past, council has sort of just, you know, arbitrarily decided, look, let's send a fee to referendum because one or two individuals may not like the fee. Why don't we just send it out to referendum? And then that fee or that organization is forced to go up to referendum just because a couple individuals didn't like what was going on with the fee or didn't like the fee itself. And so what we decided to do was, well, you know, let's bypass that process. Let's make sure that council has all of the information to make educated votes on whether or not a fee should go to referendum. And so what we've done is we've created a committee whose sole purpose it is just to provide recommendations on things, to look at MOUs for all of the fees, to look at the audited financial statements, to bring in key people involved with the implementation of fees, regardless of what the fee is, and ask them questions. Ask them, you know, whether or not the implementation is running well, whether or not, you know, we want to review this fee further in the future. And I think it provides us with a mechanism of oversight that we've sorely been missing. And at least from the discussions that I've had with members of other USA schools and looking at a discussion on ancillary fees and a paper that we're currently authoring, that this is something that doesn't exist in other schools at all. And what's happened in some cases, and I use Queens as a great example, they had hundreds and hundreds of dollars, almost twice as much that we pay in ancillary fees, did Queens pay in ancillary fees. And then their council just at one point said, well, I think we should send everything up to referendum. And that's a problem, A, for voter fatigue, B, for just information and awareness, because students won't have a chance to read, you know, 26 MOUs or something like that, right? And more than likely not, they'll see, oh, well, I could save all of this money. I'm going to vote no to everything, and so that I get all this money back. And so to avoid those sorts of problems, we allow ourselves a committee that does proper, regular oversight and review to make sure that all of these things are doing their job. And then as a result of that, we also avoid things like at McMaster, where they've had fees stockpile, you know, $1 million, right? Because no one ever said, hey, let's review this fee. Maybe it's too much. Maybe the operation of this organization can run on less money. So let's pull the fee back a little bit. Let's rein it in, instead of continually bearing over a surplus. And this will allow us to make sure that all of this, you know, continues on. And I mean, we always say Brock has some of the lowest ancillary fees in the province. I generally would like to keep it that way. I mean, that's kind of my fiscal hawk nature. I'd like that students, you know, they get the most for their money, but they also don't pay an egregious amount of money. And so this committee does, in essence, what I had always espoused to do in council, but now there's a group of students who does an open and transparent process. They're the ones that can get some really good insight, involvement, you know, finance work and related information along with it. And it just provides a mechanism of oversight and information to the committee or to the council that the council never had at its purview before, right? It sort of had to make decisions ad hocly based on whatever a certain councillor knew and whoever gave certain testimony. Now that it essentially works like the ethics committee. Now there's, you know, information, there's proper process to go along with all of it.
And then there'll be reports?
Correct. Just like any other committee, it'll have reports.
Okay. So the students per credit pay $43.82, according to BUSU.net, for Brock University Students Union ancillary fees, and $44 for Brock University ancillary fees. The BUSU fees include things like the Strategic Expansion Fund, which is $7 a credit, Brock TV, which is $3 a credit, Brock Press, which is $2.80 a credit, and so forth. So you can find out that information at busu.net. And part of my work as a journalist has also been to look into not only the fees themselves, but the referendums, the political process or the political results that led to those fees being implemented. So one of the things I'm doing looking forward is talking to Josh Stone, the government operations manager, about some of the political data. I guess you call it the polling data, or how many ballots were spoiled, how many people voted yes, how many people voted no, what was the proportion of the student body at the time that actually did vote, what effect did online voting have and so forth. And I think that by doing this, we can establish a political landscape so that future counselors and executives don't have to reinvent the wheel every time they're trying to explain something. They can actually just look at, hey, here's all the facts, and then people can make determinations from that. Again, we're talking with Cooper Millard, the president of BUSU, and Christopher Yent, the vice president of finance and administration. So one of the referendums that's coming up in October is a constitutional amendment to roll the vice president of external affairs, roll the job description for the vice president of university affairs into the newly created vice president of external affairs. It also, I believe, defines what a committee is, as well as increases the petition quorum from 2% to 7%, and the quorum for referendum votes from 10% to 14%. So I'm very interested in, what is the impetus for this kind of increase of petition? In real numbers, that would be about 350 people required for a signature, up to approximately 1,000 individuals required for a signature. So what is the impetus for that?
Well, I guess I'll start, and then you can possibly bounce off me, Cooper. So the first thing I'd like to note is that there's a section there that you missed, in that the constitutional amendments will also address the fact that we have a bit of a lacking amount of oversight and accountability for our board of directors, in that certain members of our board of directors can be elected, but they can't be easily removed. And what we ran into, I'm going to say 2 years ago when I was on the board, we had two members of the board that didn't actually attend board meetings. They never came to board meetings. And it becomes very difficult to reach quorum for a board meeting if you don't have two members attend the board regularly. And so what we've allowed in the constitutional updates, and I'll get to your question, is that we have a mechanism of oversight now where a double supermajority requiring both a motion initiated by the board of directors as well as a motion approved by the student council can remove and replace members of the board should need warrant it. And then that way there's both a check and balance, so that the board can't just arbitrarily say, well, we don't like this individual, let's get him off. And the council can't also arbitrarily decide to pull members from the board. In addition to that, so I'll go back to your question of the 2% to 7%, as well as the 10% to 14% for a general election requirement to be valid. We found there's a couple different issues, but we found that in the growth of the campus overall, having 10% of students vote on something and then the fee become mandatory, let's say it's a fee, is less than what we want, given that if you're going to choose a fee that's even, let's just say for the, you know, the sake of it, $100, I mean, to have only 10% say that they want the fee and then 50% plus one of the 10% say that they want the fee, that's, you know, 5.1% of people saying we want a whole new fee, and yet 100% of people must agree to the fee being paid. And so we wanted to try and alleviate that. And then in addition to that, the 2% to 7% quorum requirement for a petition to be valid, what we've also found, at least from my experience, and Cooper, you can address this from your experience because they're often different, that the people that sign a petition are often not the people that vote. They're often two separate quadrants of people. And so our hope is that by allowing this as a facilitation mechanism, we'll find more people that were a separate set of the student body, right? I mean, the people that may sign the petition are just people in the hallway, but they may become people that go and vote. And so by requiring more people to sign a petition, this is more people that you're inadvertently providing information to who may recognize, hey, look, there's a political process going on. Oh, we vote on stuff. Well, what do we vote on? Well, maybe we want to get involved in the voting process. And suddenly when they see that their signature has been dropped on something, they may actually open up the email that they get in their Brock mail and will drive, you know, we could, you know, the 5% that's there may directly go to a 5% increase in overall voter turnout. I mean, I'm being a little bit zealous there and assuming that there's a direct, you know, one-to-one carryover from people who signed the petition to people who vote. But it's a separate quadrant of people that may never been vote or never voted before or ever got involved with the process. And so by allowing this as a mechanism, we're saying that, hey, there's another way for students to get involved in the process. In addition to that, we also recognize the fact that the campus is much bigger now than it's ever been before, right? And 300 students to take something to referendum for students to vote on is a very small amount of the overall population of the university. We want a sizable portion of people to say that, look, we want something. We think this is valid. I mean, we believe fundamentally that if the cause is valid, if the fee is valid, if the idea is valid, getting the signatures is not difficult. And I think both of us can speak to the fact that when you're an executive and you go get signatures to be nominated in an exec election, it's not that difficult to go and collect the signatures, right? And so if the idea is valid, you're going to get the signatures pretty readily. But I mean, the example that I always use, I think that, you know, I'm going to be much less likely. I could probably find, you know, 300 people that would sign on to a Chris Yent fee to get a Chris Yent fee to go. And I'm, to the listeners out there, I'm not opposing a Chris Yent fee or suggesting that this is a good idea. But you're much less likely to find 1,000 people that think that the Chris Yent fee to give me money is a good idea. And I think that when it's a valid idea, getting the signatures won't be a difficulty. And these are people that we didn't get involved in the process before, and people who may have been outliers or outcasts of the overall voting process. And these were people that will now get involved in the voting process. Anything to add, Cooper?
If we're talking about the 2% to 7%, that's something that we were, as an executive team, planning on doing since our executive retreat. The sheer number of referendums that have been coming to the table in the last 2 or 3 years, I don't know what my position on that is. However, the fact of the matter is there are more and more coming every single year. We want as much as the student body to know about them as possible. And we assumed the more people who signed off on a petition meant that the more people, A, thought this was a good idea, B, the more people knew about it, C, the more people are interacting with BUSU in our governance, and D, more people would actually be talking about student politics and talking about. So it's all, I mean, mutually beneficial. It's not to control the number of referendums, as although that may be a result of this. It will be quality control, not control for control's sake. It'll be the number of people actually knowing about this, being educated on the topics, and not just going out in 2 or 3 days and finding 305 signatures, which is our process of now. And that was, I mean, representative of our school 10, 15 years ago. However, we have 18,000 students now. And if we want to be truly representative and truly have something that's going to the floor in a referendum format, that's going to make sense, we have to have as many students to know about it, be educated about it, and voting on it as possible. And the 14% is a bare minimum. I mean, in the last couple of years with our online voting capabilities, we're hovering anywhere between 20 and 30% turnout. This year, I think we all had a goal of 40%. And don't hold me to it, Josh is probably pulling his hair out right now. But I really think that's achievable because of the technology, because of our engaged students, because of our awesome campus, and the fact that we are like a tight community. I really think this referendum, petition portion of the Constitution is really going to benefit our students in the long run.
For some perspective, the 2012 Brock TV referendum had 19% participant. The 2012 Brock Radio referendum had 13% participation. And the 2013 Student Life had, I believe it was something like 24%. 4,000 students voted, 4,060 students voted for in the Student Life referendum. 2,000 people voted in the Brock Radio referendum. About 3,000 people voted in the Brock TV referendum. And I guess that's also why I'm interested in finding out about all of this past data, so that we can really start to understand the political demographic. Quickly, the BUSAC still has the authority at any time to implement a referendum. So the elected representatives on BUSAC, two-thirds of them can at any time debate and then motion and then have a referendum brought forward. I'm just letting the listeners know about that mechanism. So if students want to see a change, they can also approach BUSAC. They don't have to avoid the governance process, or not necessarily avoid, but they don't have to use the sort of last result of a petition. They can actually come in and make presentations and get BUSAC on board, and then there's no reason for having a petition in the first place. Not even a question. I'm just putting that out there because it is part of the work I'm trying to do here is inform the listeners and the general public that engagement is possible and effective. So
and get, cool.
Two of the four referendums that are going forward in the fall, so 50% were initiated by student council. The other two came through petition. So it's a fully reasonable mechanism to allow a referendum to go out, and council always has that initiative. And if you believe that you have an idea that, you know, you may or may not want to send through petition, but believe it's valid, bring it to your representative. You can find all your representatives on www.busu.net/representation, and you can see your counselors for your faculty. It's their job to relay that information up to us. And so if you believe you have an idea that's valid and you want to see go out to a vote and go out to a referendum, bring it to your counselor so they can bring it to the council.
We've been talking with BUSU executives, Cooper Millard, the president of BUSU, and Christopher Yant, the vice president of finance and administration. For more information, visit busu.net. Thank you for listening today, and thank you guys for coming into the studio to talk.
Thank you very much. This.